welcome to another episode of the Audaciousness Podcast with me, Helen Strong.
And me, Maribel Ortega. In this podcast, we showcase individuals who have set themselves bold and audacious goals and have worked to achieve them with the aim of inspiring others to also set themselves audacious goals and to create a positive movement in the world.
We'd like to highlight the fact that even regular people like you and me can have audacious goals and that role models are in fact all around us. Each and every one of us can have an impact in some way.
Thanks so much for joining us. We're delighted to have you with us. So Helen, tell us about the guests we're going to hear from today.
Yeah, sure. We're going to hear from Dr. Ousmane Pam, who is based in Dakar in Senegal on the west coast of Africa, and who is the founder and director of a network of eco-villages across the Sahel. And the Sahel is the area which stretches from Senegal on the Atlantic coast to Eritrea on the coast of the Red Sea. Mm-hmm. And it's bordered on the north by the Sahara Desert and on the south by rich savanna land. And the reason I'm saying that is because I wasn't sure where it was at the beginning when I learned the word. And Dr. Pam explains in this interview how the Sahel, or at least the area where he lives in Senegal, used to be like a paradise, but that over the past few decades, it's been turned into desert land by poor agricultural practices, and that now people are working to revive the area and to bring it back to the lush and abundant habitat that it once was. So this truly is an audacious task. And just before we go to the interview, I'd like to give a mention to the person who introduced us to Ousmane. And this was actually one of our very first guests on our podcast, a friend of mine called Jen Taylor, who is a teacher and who, with a few other teachers, formed a group called Teachers for Schools, and that has helped raise money to fund the building of a well in one of Dr. Pam's eco-villages. So thanks very much to Jen for the introduction and for giving us the opportunity to speak to Ousmane. This was a fascinating interview, as we'll find out.
Indeed. So let's listen to the interview with Ousmane now, and we'll come back in around half an hour and we'll discuss what we learned from that interview. We hope you enjoy it.
So hello, Ousmane, and thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us for our podcast, Audaciousness. Let's get straight into it by you telling us something about the audacious work that you do. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Helen. It's a pleasure to be here. And I think we are engaged in something huge and extremely big. We're trying to reverse the Sahara Desert on the Senegalese and Mauritanian side together with villages. It's a huge task, and we're having also some successes, but we still have a long way to go.
What do you mean about reverse the Sahara Desert? Can you explain that a little bit more?
Decades ago, I mean, the part of the land I live in northern Senegal was a forest with the lions, with the hippos, with crocodiles, with a diversity of animals. And my grandmother, you know, who passed away about 6 years ago, and then who lived in this beautiful area, paradise-like, you know, used to tell us how it was when she was young, because she lived quite for some time, you know, a century and 9 years. And then she was mentally alert till the very last minute. And she fed us with stories of how it was when she was young, when she was, when she gave birth to my father, and, you know. So, and then I realized that, you know, this was just like a paradise. It was just like, you know, because today when you compare the situation to what my grandmother tells us is, it's a complete barren place. It's like a lunar scape, you know, landscape with no trees. It's very hot in May, June, July, with extreme temperatures close to 50 degrees Celsius, with windstorms, animals having less food to eat, and humans also facing the same challenges. And in addition to this, people are leaving these places to go to cities, urban centers like Dakar, like Nouakchott to find better living conditions. And then this is also a very important historic place because it was the kingdom of the Futa Toro with lots of institutions. That's the place where slavery was forbidden, you know, in the 1766. There was a Toro do revolution in 1776 that's coincided with the independence of the U.S. Of America. And at that time, you know, the religious leaders, political leaders got together and had a chart of transparency, leadership, of forbidding, you know, human, forbidding slavery, and really trying to promote human rights. But this is not known in the outside world. And this region is extremely important in also the spreading of peaceful Islam throughout, you know, West Africa. And this is my heritage. And now we're trying to reconnect the dots, trying also to bring back, you know, this cultural wealth, trying to bring back, well-being, welfare, you know, among the communities. This is the task we're facing at the moment.
Wow. That sounds like a paradise indeed, what you were explaining there. And it obviously sustained people. If your grandmother lived until she was over 100, then obviously it sustained people in this area too. I'm curious as to what were the reasons why it's degraded from this paradise to what you describe now in such a short period of time. Can you shed a little light on that?
It's a combination of different factors. We had up to the 70s, we had complete organic food, organic farming, no pesticides, no chemicals. But at some stage, our national government was convinced by international financial organizations like the IMF, the World Bank, and all these international partners. They persuaded our governments, Mauritanian government, Senegalese government, and Mali, who share this river, to put dams on the river. And because it costs a lot, and they also wanted, you know, to develop cash crops, you know, to pay back all these debts. And one of the conditions was to clear the forest and start, you know, agriculture. And we are very close to the desert. And being close to the desert with all the degradation that is brought by desertification itself, and all these bad agricultural policies, which also, you know, use a lot of chemicals, a lot of pesticides, which pollute the rivers. And so this, you know, has resulted in a complete ecological and socioeconomic, you know, disaster in the region. And also it was at a time when people thought everything that our national government decided was right thing to go. And today, I think all the people in this area have realized what a big mistake it was to clear the forest, destroy the resources, and depend on cash agriculture. Today, my area, which was created in the 1930s, we developed, you know, that was the first place where rice was grown. Of course, we had some Chinese who came to support and show us how to grow rice according to Chinese standards, which means, of course, a lot of pesticides, a lot of chemicals, and all was free because it was also part of the seduction, you know, arsenal of the Chinese to show us that communism was much better than capitalism. But anyway, here, both capitalism and communism had the same result. That was the degradation of our lands, of our resources. And so many people have realized now how bad it was, you know, to follow this so-called modern agriculture. And also the nutrition indicators are in red because people do not have the food diversity they used to have. They do not have the quality they used to have. And as a result, we know we've got new disease, like diabetes, hypertension, and all these, you know, nutrition related, you know, disease are now developing in addition to poverty that is also really developing also in this area. And I think there's a general awareness of really what needs to be done at the moment to reverse all these effects. And I think people are starting to be very cautious about what the governments and the international monetary funds and what they prescribe.
Definitely, and it sounds like, or my understanding is that a similar story is being played out in other parts of the world. We spoke on this podcast earlier to somebody from India who explained something quite similar happening. For us to then say, right, okay, we need to change this, that's obviously from the grassroots level is a huge task against all of these multinational organizations. So how are you going about doing that? What are you doing to reverse this?
I think also using the same channels that these international, these multinationals use, like education, like influencing decision makers, like using TVs, radios, etc., going to the villages, organizing a number of events that will raise the awareness of the people. For example, I'll just give you an example of the southern part of my country in Casamance, for example. In Casamance, we have the last sacred forest in the country, sacred forest, because when people are dead, they are buried with seeds. And these seeds, when they grow up, they are seen as the reincarnation of the souls of the dead people. And it's and then it creates a real, sacred areas, like temples, natural temples, where people go for their initiations. When there is a crisis in the community, that's the place where they go and discuss honestly. It's the place where they connect with the ancestors. To a foreigner, this is just like wood. It's nothing. It's wood. So when they see this, they see how much paper they can make out of it, how much of industrial product they can get. I mean, for us, when we see this, we see ancestors, we see our culture, we see our balance with nature, we see a number of things that other people don't necessarily see. So it's important to remind the younger generations how important the wildlife, how important the forests are to our culture, to our balance. And also telling them that also this notion of well-being that the West in general sells to Africa is not totally appropriate. Of course, we will not close ourselves to the best part in the Western cultures and other cultures. We would like also at the same time combine these best parts with also the best parts of our tradition. But also we are very clear that not everything also in our traditions were absolutely best. So we are trying to put something delicate together, like the best parts of our local cultures and traditions with also what the best that the West offers, so that we can move forward. I think this is the delicate balance that we as communities, we as local governments, as leaders also need to design so that it's widely adopted. And then this will be the seeds of change, real change, sustainable change in the region.
Wow, that sounds like a big enterprise that you're doing, and that you're moving forward. Usman, you just used the word seeds, and that reminded me of I want to think of the origins, because I'm always interested in that. I can imagine that you've listened through all your childhood and growing up and becoming a man to the storytellings of your grandmother. But then at some point, something must have happened, that something changed, something clicked. What was it that gave you this inspiration to start this work?
Well, as I've told you, my grandmother was a real university to me and to my brothers and sisters also, because she had a large herd of cows. And during the summer vacations, I would, like my brothers and sisters, also go and help her look after her cattle. So we would go far away from the village, like 5 kilometers, 60 kilometers, and then we would stay the whole day looking at the animals grazing. When it's very hot, we get under the shade of a tree. And that's at the time when my grandmother, you know, shares all these stories. I think that was absolutely fascinating, opening so many windows, so many doors in our small brains. And so she told us, you know, all the different kinds of trees, the use, the medicinal use of some herbs, etc. So, of course, when we were far away from the village, we had no water, we had no food, but I mean, we were fully fed and nourished with all these stories. And in addition also to this, because, you know, so many things happen at the same time, in my village where, rice agriculture was started first, we have realized that our lands are dead. And when you scratch the land up to the level of the water, you will not see any worms, which is a sign of vitality of the earth, because the land has been receiving so many poisons, it's completely dead. And my village was seen as a model, really, because it was the first village to have electricity in the region. And of course, at night, this small village with all these electricity bulbs was like a spacecraft of aliens in the middle of nowhere. Everywhere else was dark. And this was also made by the Chinese. They also showed us, you know, films, Chinese films, of course, relating Mao Zedong's sagas and stories. So they were Chinese films in subtitles with English. We did not understand much because we spoke no English, no Chinese, but it was already magic for us to see movies, and people from other villages used to come. And also my village was a place where people could come and learn new jobs like mechanics. And, the yields were very important. And then at a moment we realized that all the yields were just going down. People were getting into debts. The crisis was so deep, but the government left us. And that coincided also with the time when the IMF, the World Bank, told our local governments, don't invest in non-productive sectors like agriculture, health, education. And also that was the time then when also the Chinese left us. So we were all left alone. And we decided at some time to come together as a village. So all the students, teachers, herders, farmers, we got together for 3 days under what we called reflection days, community reflection days. And we came up with a document that says, okay, if you want to develop farming, this is what needs to happen. If you want to develop health, education, this is what needs to be developed. So I took part, an active part in all this in the village. And we were searching for some, sustainable solutions. And I also made my first steps into the eco-village movement as a teacher, as an educator. And finally, I was responsible for the academic program of an American program called the Living Roots in Senegal. So we would go to villages and, you know, help with micro projects and all this. So I think was also helping build, you know, some new ideas and a new vision. And at some point in my life, I went to Auroville in India, where I attended a course on eco-village design education. And back to my village, where also this movement was, to my country, where this movement was also emerging, because in Senegal in 2002, that was the first eco-village network was registered. And as I was working with them, I also brought a program in my village. And then we explained to the villagers what an eco-village is and how to go about it and all the strategies. And then we got into this. And a few years later, for the first time in the history of my village, we were promoted commune. And I was elected mayor. That was really the first time that the village had a mayor. And all I had to offer my village was to transition into an eco-village. And we developed some projects here and there. And of course, I think the hardest part was really to change the mental and cultural paradigm so that everyone is geared to action and to sustainable, you know, sustainable practices. And of course, we succeeded part of this, and other parts are still a challenges to the community. And I think all this conquered to really maybe give me the ideas, the vision I have for, you know, to include also surrounding communities, and even now work with our neighboring country, Mauritania, and we're working together with the communities and leaders, and our vision is now to create a trans-border eco-village hub, which combines 50 villages in Mauritania and 50 villages in Senegal, and so that we can really start fighting, you know, work to reverse desertification and also reinvent our present and our future.
I wonder, Osman, if you could describe what one of these eco-villages look like. Could you paint a picture for us as to what an eco-village is and how it's different to another village?
I'll give you an example, the example of Lobudu. In 2004, Lobudu, which is a small Mauritanian village of 900 inhabitants, was affected as very much as, like, you know, all the other villages. I mean, all the scenario I described a little earlier, dryness, sandstorms, high temperatures, people living because they have no food, people living because, you know, they don't see a better future for themselves, and especially the youth. And at some point, under the leadership of a local village chief, who is a retired, you know, educator, so they decided to give one part of their land and then fence it. So the investment here is the fencing, which is very minimal. And about 10 years later, because there are no animals that overgraze and kill and eat and destroy, so this has become a real dense forest with local trees. And when you get into this, it's at least 15 degrees less in terms of temperatures. And this has become also an animal sanctuary. All the other animals, like boars, like, you know, rabbits, have just, you know, used this, like, you know, a sanctuary, a safe place. And bees are back. They use these bees, you know, their honey, you know, to make medicine, to eat. So, and the animals have all year round, the animals have, you know, food. And also women are organized in cooperatives. They work together, they, you know, they share the wealth they produce in this village. And at the same time, they have also a band of traditional singers called griots here. And then the griots, they are totally different from the other kind of griots you will see in West Africa. Because here, most of their production is about the preservation of the environment, about how to make a much better life, how to revive our legends, our stories, etc. When I listen to this, to their songs, I really have goosebumps, because it just talks to me directly, deeper. And so I think they're also helping, you know, the communities outside also better understand the necessity of really trying to preserve their natural resources. So today, when you go to this village at any time of the year, you know, you will find food. People are very open, very welcoming. We have a number of international also visitors who come. It's so peaceful. I think what makes it really different from the other villages, I think it's the level of awareness, mm-hmm. of the importance of how to create and design ways that will produce wealth, that will produce peace, and you know, and also they're so generous. They also, I think, they're educating also surrounding villages. So we want to use this as an engine, this community as an engine, to really pull all the surrounding villages and so get inspired what's happening there, both on the Senegalese side, Mauritanian side and Senegalese side. And in Senegal also, we have a couple of villages that, you know, have a similar trajectory. So for us, these progress made by the people, ordinary people, I think are wonderful, powerful stories to be shared in this region so that other people also, other villages can also say, oh, why can't we do the same thing? Why can't we, you know, and then they go to these villages, which are really open laboratories where they learn. And I think one of the roles of REDES, which is my organization that stands for Network for Eco-Village Emergence and Development in the Sahel region, is also to connect all these energies and then make them also known throughout the region so that, you know, in the next 10 years, we hope, you know, to have a green, verdant, prosperous also region. I think we are already in the right direction. And I would like also to take advantage of this and also thank all our international partners really that have been very understanding and supporting, like Teachers for School that has already, you know, supported with a well in La Hill, where we have also around this one, we have an intercommunity training center. We're developing a food forest. And at the moment we are developing a nursery for 200,000 plants, which is huge. And mm-hmm. this will be planted in 20 villages. So if this is can be repeated, you know, on a permanent basis, I think, you know, in the next decade, you know, we will come to fantastic results. Everyone will be happy about. I think also one of the problems in the Sahel region is water. In the past 2 years, we have, with the support of our international partners, dug 32 wells in 32 different villages. And when we say water, it also gives birth to a number of other projects. Like, for example, in Ariwele, we gave them a well, which, by the way, the water is fantastic. So it tastes so delicious. Myself, I drank from it. And the water, the quality of the water was absolutely, you know, amazing. And so the village had water to drink and also their cattle. And at the same time, they developed around this well, they developed a community orchard where they produce a number of vegetables they can also eat and sell, you know, in the market. And recently we have also brought them a number of seeds and bags so that they can also develop a nursery, a plant nursery. And I think all this combined, I think really helps, you know, raise the level of the living standards in the villages. It creates hope and it federates people around what is really essential and how to live a good life. And this is absolutely uplifting.
Wow, you are so inspiring, Usman. You are a very inspiring leader, I have to say. And while listening to you describe what you have done and all the things that have happened already, I was thinking, this is not about sustainable living. This was just the start. It's about so much more. I loved what you said before, reinvent our present and our future. What are all the implications? Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, you've said it already, but it's about, you mentioned the culture, about how living a happy life. It's not just sustainable or sustainability.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of all this at the same time, because I think it's not very sustainable if our notion of joy, of well-being is imposed on us by other people. You know, there's no such a thing where people can say, okay, for your joy, for your happiness, for your way of life, you need to do this and this and this and this, like, you know, big gurus. I think we are at a time when we need to stop all this. And we as a local community think about all these things and for ourselves, and also see how we can also develop our connections with our own environment and with the people around us. I think it's an active laboratory where we also try to reinvent, you know, what is friendship, what is fraternity across borders, what is really what it means, you know, to live a safe, peaceful, productive life. And I think all these things come into consideration at the same time. So in the past, we were educated, you know, by our grandmothers, by our mothers. By the way, women play a very important role in our communities. They are the really the main actors. They are the educators. They are the wealth producers. And then with the Western schools, all this changed, you know, because when people started to go to schools, you know, a new administration was born, and then I think it completely upset the traditional organizations in our local country. So women are natural, you know, leaders, natural educators. I think we need also to restore this in our communities. We are beginning to lose our legends, our stories, because we feel completely overwhelmed by what's happening on internet, on all these international media. And at the same time, we realize that these international media are creating some very thick, invisible walls of fears between people. When someone in England wants to go to the Gambia or to Africa, they miss, oh, disease, oh, danger, no security, Ebola, and all this. I think the reality is much wider than this. Of course, we all have challenges, whether in England or here in Senegal. I mean, there are challenges all over the world. But I think we need at some point, you know, really to destroy these invisible psychological walls that prevent people from interacting, from being friends, from developing fraternal bonds. So I think it's all this at the same time. We need, as our first president, Leopold Sédar Senghor, who was also a poet, who said, we need to be deeply rooted in our cultures and at the same time open to the rest of the world. I think this is really a driving force for many people of my generation and also in Africa. So I think we have a troubled past, slavery, and slavery is not over yet. It's still a present day, you know, thing, because what's happening today in Africa, in all over the world, our resources are being taken away. People are triggering some wars between people so that they can take diamonds, they can take, you know, a number of other, you know, minerals. And I think greed is really destroying, is what is destroying not only African communities, but also European communities. I think the same forces that are destroying Africa are also undermining, you know, Europeans, are also undermining, you know, other people in other places of the world. So it's not the North against the South or the West against the East. I think it's the same dark forces that are really like, you know, that are just, you know, taking people's energy, people's resources, and the resources are being, the wealth is being concentrated in less than 1% of the global population. And 90% are dying of disease or lack of food. I think this is not rational. It's just like a pyramid standing on the top. So we need to find a way to get the pyramid, you know, perhaps the other way around. If this is not a good example, we need to create a circle of friendship where people can, no matter what their races are, no matter where they live, where we can really hold hands and together reinvent a new planet, a new life across borders. But again, we need to clearly to identify these forces that sends us toxic energy, that exploit us, that, you know, really keep our hope and our positive energy down. So I think in every country, in every place, region in the world, such forces exist. And I think it requires a lot of energy for local leaders, local people, ordinary people, you know, to come together and identify those and try to change, you know, the current situation.
Yeah, I completely agree, Usman. We all have a large challenge on our hands at the moment. I'd like to end with a positive note, if we may. And I'm going to ask you our final question, which we always ask to our guests at the end of our interviews. And that is to do with the name of our podcast, which is Audaciousness. And the audacious part relates to the work that you're doing, which is clearly audacious in all of these eco-villages that you're that you're starting up. The word nest relates to a piece of land, a spit of land, which juts out into the sea and remains standing no matter what the sea is throwing at it in all kinds of weathers. So our final question to you is, what is it that gives you the solid grounding to keep on standing no matter what life and its challenges are throwing at you?
Thank you for the question. And I believe, you know, all these local wisdoms that I learned from my grandmother, from the community, and from my also education in the French school system, etc. I think this gives me perhaps a unique perspective on things. And one is, there is a very important proverb in Wolof. Wolof is a local culture here that says, nit garabam, which means a person is another person's medicine. And this is absolutely central to our own vision here. I think what's important is if we want to find out who we are, we need to be at the service of other people all the time. And of course, you know, we may be at the heart of our tempers. We may be, you know, surrounded by dark forces, etc. But I think what's really important is to keep faith in humanity, to keep faith that you know, we're still growing together as humans, hopefully we will get there. You know, I think we are on a journey, and we're facing so many challenges. I guess, you know, our children, though they may have, you know, bigger ecological challenges, I think they've got bigger chances, you know, really to have a to connect with other youth in the world, so that, you know, they can also live together in much better conditions than we do today. Yes, I think there's hope. Hope is here, and it's just like, of course, this flame in the wind, but it's resisting. And we hope also there will be more candles around, and then people can really start thinking about how to reinvent our fraternity and live like brothers and sisters all around the world. This is their faith we have. We also trying also to get some of the youth also understand. And I think more and more people are also understanding this. I see many of the people who have taken part in our different programs are also already starting their own, you know, their own centers, their own actions. And this is really spreading, whether in southern Mauritania, whether in northern rural Senegal, there are a number of actions and initiatives that are connecting and that are also really going in the right direction.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Usman. It's been such a pleasure talking to you and finding out about your work there. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed. That was very inspiring.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you, Maribel. It's a pleasure. And also, I'd like to thank Jen Taylor for connecting us together. And it's really an inspiring moment sharing with you. And hopefully you will also help spread all this. And many more people, you know, will also connect to this. And then we can create, you know, a global, positive global energy that will, you know, help, you know, change our situation, global situation, much faster.
An interesting, thought-provoking, engaging, inspiring conversation with Usman. And listening to that again, Helen, what was going through your head and what were the key things that you took from that conversation?
Oh, there was a lot going through my head, and there were so many things that I took from that conversation. There's so much I could say about what Usman talked about, but I'm going to begin with one point and we'll see how far we get with the time that we've got. So I'm going to start with the point near the beginning, when Usman was explaining how poor land management and agricultural practices led to the area being degraded from an abundant paradise to this barren and polluted lunascape, as he called it, where hardly anything grows and the land can't sustain people anymore, and people become susceptible to diseases and end up living in poverty. And I could understand completely what he was saying about the causes of it, the greed of a few corrupt and corruptible individuals who want to make a quick buck out of selling poisonous substances that are damaging to the environment and to human health, and keeping people in this position of slavery and misery. And from my understanding, this type of thing's been going on for hundreds, even thousands of years. And if I've understood history correctly, it seems to have been getting even more intense in recent decades and even just these past 18 months. What were you thinking, Maribel, as Usman was talking about that bit? I'd be curious to what was going through your mind.
I was thinking about Haiti, because that's so close, so a similar situation that is close to my personal experiences. And yes, indeed, it's the greed of a few and a system that allows that to happen, that some can benefit immensely and others have to pay for it. And that just reminded me of mountains with lots of forest and trees and green and animals and living habitats for plants and animals in Haiti that during the 20th century were destroyed and just transformed to make wood. And now the less plants and trees there are, then the more susceptible is as the earth to any kind of to rain. It just starts washing away the upper layers of the earth where you can plant, and it's just sad.
And also, while he was talking about that, he mentioned something about the reasons why the land degraded, and something he mentioned about the 1%. And that reminded me of a book that I'd read very recently. It's a book by an Indian lady called Vandana Shiva, and it's called Oneness versus the 1%. And it's called the 1%, although nowadays, I mean, there's the world population is over 7 billion. And so this 1%, which we're talking about, is probably much closer to 0.001%, where the wealth of the whole planet's wealth is just held in the hands of a few disgustingly wealthy people, you know. Anyway, so I wanted to mention this book connected to this topic. It's well worth reading if you're interested in researching it. And I just want to say a little bit about it, because I thought it was a fascinating book. I only read it. It only came out last year, and I only read it recently. So Usman was talking about communism and capitalism having the same result in Senegal. Whatever method you use, they were both agricultural, poor agricultural
disaster.
Practices. Exactly.
Yeah.
But what Vandana Shiva talks about in her book is the concept of philanthrocapitalism.
Oh.
And what that is where these extremely rich people, and I don't need name any names, I think you know who I'm talking about, industries such as, technology and pharmaceuticals and finance, energy and agriculture and food production and so on, use their immense wealth and power just for the purpose of creating even more financial wealth for themselves, but they do this by bypassing democracies. I mean, these are non-elected people who've taken it upon themselves to dictate how the world is going to work, how the world is going to function, and they own most of the governments around the world. And they impose these totalitarian ideas to countries around the world. And Usman was talking about, you know, this totalitarian idea of this is how agriculture should be. And I mentioned this example of talking to somebody from India in a previous episode where, you know, you need to use this pesticide in order to grow this one product. You know, there's monoculture, there's one agriculture, one science, one health service, one government, one way of doing things all over the world with the purpose of creating wealth for this handful of people, but at the expense of, you know, the destruction of the environment and the habitats and the basic right of humans and other animals to live a free and peaceful existence on this planet. And if you look around us now, we're seeing this all pan out right now in most countries in the world. It's absolutely crazy.
Yes, you remember that documentary that I think we both watched, that it's that monoculture and using pesticides that creates poor crops, fruit and vegetables that taste like nothing. And once you switch from that huge with big machines type of agriculture and you mix it up with different things, and every year you can harvest different products, then the soil starts recovering, and the food that you can harvest starts coming out with taste. So it's just easy, and the practicability is just for some people, and not for the rest.
Yeah, it's the difference between diversity and homogeneity, isn't it? And we see this all around us. We need diversity. Nature is diverse. And we think as humans that we can destroy that.
Yeah, well, we also have it even in companies. Remember when we interviewed Naya Orduña, she said, we need diverse teams because they are more creative. They think of more options. So yeah, not only in nature, also among human beings, it's more productive.
Everywhere, yeah. Well, what's one of the key things that you took out of the interview then, Maribel? I know you asked a couple of questions about that.
Yes, the thing that for me, like strung a chord, I'm always looking for like this kind of like emotional connection to whatever the people are doing. And I love the story of the grandmother and how the goal of reversing the desert that has become, it growed beyond being just an agricultural venture and something only to improve the vegetation around, but also it was connected with storytelling, with the culture where they grew up, because the space where that kind of exchange happened was gone. And now when it's coming back, it's possible that it takes place again. And also, Usman, he impressed me in several ways. First of all, the way he spoke was so inspiring that after our interview, I sent him an email asking, what are the ways that people can help and support, even if you can't come to Senegal? And then he connected me to one of his colleagues. So if you're listening and if you want to help, certainly one good way is to go there directly. But if you can't travel for whatever reason, there are several possibilities of supporting them from wherever you live.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'll mention a little bit about that later because I've got something else to add to that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, what you were saying about, but that, I thought that was an excellent question that you asked about. It's not all about sustainability, isn't it? Because sustainability sounds like a word which kind of, for me, lacks emotion. You know, it's just like, we need to do this because it's sustainable.
It's kind of like the thing to do nowadays. To do,
exactly. Yeah, it's just this word.
Yeah.
And I want to connect that with something that I loved what Usman said about the notion of joy and well-being. And I think this is what is connected to it, the storytelling and the culture.
Yeah.
And the joy and the well-being that comes just with being in nature and treating nature as it, you know, as you would like to be treated yourself. And that our notion of joy and well-being, as Usman put it, should not be imposed by someone else. And I think that is completely correct because only we individually can decide what makes us happy and what pushes our buttons. Nobody else can possibly know that. And it's very important that we recognize this and take responsibility for creating, you know, the situations and the conditions that can result in our own happiness. There was something I'm going to quote Usman here. He said, there's no such thing where people can say, okay, for your joy, for your happiness, for your way of life, you need to do this and this and this. And he said, we're at a time when we need to stop all this. And I completely agree, because if someone else tells you what you need to do in order to be happy, and that person is driven by less than favorable motives, and we've already mentioned some of those possible people already, then you're at the mercy of that person's whims and you're not at all free to make your own decisions. So it's absolutely crazy to live having somebody else tell you what to do or not to do or what to believe or not to believe. Only you can know what's best for you. And yet we're living in, you know, some societies we're living in right now where this type of psychological and behavioral control seems to be getting tighter and tighter. And people are told what they're allowed to do, where they're allowed to go and what they should believe and all of this. And that, to me, couldn't be further removed from what it means to be human and to live our lives to our full potential. It's like living in a prison. We need to be released and to be able to achieve what we're meant to be able to achieve, to achieve our full potential.
Yes, that I think he used beautiful words to explain that. And what I also like the most, because he said, we've done a lot, but there's still lots to do. So they welcome any helping hand. What I think what I found the most inspiring in his way of speaking and just his presence is the hope. Mm-hmm. The hope that he has in things becoming better. And for me, the best way of summarizing everything that he had to say, and for that I'm gonna have to quote him, is we need to reinvent our present and our future. And you can only do that when you are making choices and taking action based on opportunity and hope and not on fear.
Yeah,
what could happen.
Exactly. And it's lovely that he ended on this positive note. And I think that it's a good thing that we asked that final question when we do, because it kind of tends to make the interview end on a positive note. And yes. And it was lovely to say that there is hope and that future generations, and I'll quote Usman, future generations can actually live together in much better conditions than we do today. And I agree with that sentiment completely. I have the feeling that things are coming to a head now and that we're on the cusp of a monumental shift in the way that we live on this planet, and that those of us with love in our hearts and hope for the future will prevail over the dark forces that Usman was talking about. You know, the dark forces that have been driving this hostile and malicious agenda for far too long. I think we will come through.
I'm convinced that believing that is the only way to move forward Because the other option would be paralyzing. So, yes.
Yeah, I want to finish on one more thing that, so after the call, Usman sent me an email to say that he wanted to mention so much more in the interview, but there wasn't time. And I know it's like, no, we've only got 30 minutes. But I will mention a few extra points now. I've kind of summarized what he's written in his email. He just wanted to let listeners know that in the eco-villages, they've so far built 13 classrooms in different villages, which has given 650 kids the opportunity to attend school. Mm-hmm. They've also given free school supplies to another 30 villages, and they've created a library and a computer room with 30 secondhand machines so that the kids can learn to use computers. And in another village where there was no school, he said that when someone received a written document like a letter, they had to walk 3 miles to find someone who could read. And now some of the kids from this village school are even at university.
Oh, beautiful.
And two more things. He said that the network is developing a school greening program to educate children in practical ecology. And they're also building an inter-community center in Senegal to train local youth, women, and decision makers in eco-village design and practices. So obviously leading on to the future, thinking about the future. Mm-hmm. And then, so at the interview, at the end of the interview, and you've mentioned it already just now, that we asked him whether there was anything that we could do, and you contacted him specifically and said, what can you do if you can't go over? Is there anything we can do to help with the project? And he mentioned lots and lots of possibilities to get involved. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're interested in supporting the eco-villages in the Sahel, then please check out the website at REDES, which is REDES-ecovillages.org. And the link to that is in the show notes. And we'll finish by handing over to Usman one more time to explain how exactly people can volunteer for this project. Is there anything that we can do to help you, apart from sending you positive energies? Is there anything concrete that we can do?
Definitely. I mean, we need a lot of volunteers, caravans of volunteers to come and support this work. And those who cannot come can also help, you know, really with the work. I mean, the online work, like helping with the website, arranging, helping with the newsletters, and creating also Redis clubs all around where they can also discuss this and see how, you know, they can in one way or the other support the initiatives in this in the Sahel region. I am in touch with a university in Montreal, and the students over there are already creating, you know, they have set up a Redis club, and they're trying to see how they can, you know, best support what's going on here. And we would like to see such initiatives also thrive in many other parts of the world, so that we can create a constellation of like-minded people that can, you know, not only see what they can do, what we can do together, but also what they can do where they are to help, you know, raise all this awareness. And I think all these initiatives are not really known yet. We are just at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And we would like to see, you know, people help also with this important project, which is the Green Wall Project. That is also an initiative of the governments in Africa under the Sahara, which is to create, you know, a wall of 15 kilometers wide, not a wall like a concrete, but I mean building, you know, planting trees,
right,
from the western coast of Africa all the way to the to the eastern coast, and then it crosses countries like Senegal, Burkina Faso, Niger, and Chad, and all the way to Eritrea. And then for us, Redes, I mean, this is a fantastic vision, but I mean, as long as it is connected with the local communities, it will not be successful. So we would like, you know, to see international youth, volunteers, not only youth, I mean, people with some expertise to come and support this. Again, the communities are very open, are very peaceful. It's not war, it's not Ebola, it's, you know, we are, we want, you know, people to be bold enough, audacious to use your term, to go, you know, over these thick invisible walls to come and join and support and learn from us so that we can also learn from them. And hopefully this will have a very positive impact on the life of the people here, but also on the life of the people who come and join us in this fantastic journey. We organize academic programs, which bring together American, for example, students and Senegalese students, because also I am an educator, a university teacher. So we bring them together and they come for a semester. They can also come for 3 weeks. And during this time, they can they receive cultural orientation. They receive a number of courses. They visit very important places in Senegal, like Gore Island and all these important cultural, you know, sites in Senegal. And so they receive, you know, courses from different sorts of experts, from university teachers, from community leaders. And they also, at the same time, they learn from each other. And this is, you know, the first part of the program. And the second part of the program, they go to the villages which receive them, and they work on different micro community, you know, projects. I think this, they learn from this, are they implement it. Also, the villages also learn from this. And many of the eco villages in Senegal really have started like this, you know, with students, trying to, you know, support these local initiatives, talking to people and interacting with them. And all of a sudden, you know, there's light in many, many of the youth minds. And then they also take this over. I remember, you know, about 3 years ago in our last program before before COVID started, we were in a village about 2 hours away from Dakar. And, you know, one of the nightmares here is plastics. There are plastics all over the place because also this is a new thing. And in one afternoon, a couple of students, you know, Senegalese and American students were just picking this. And we said, hey, maybe this is also a good idea. And then we started, you know, connecting with the local schools, with the high schools. And one morning we, I mean, with the permission of all the directors of all the schools, we had 500 kids come out to pick up all the plastics. Wow. And it was just like, it was so amazing because after the cleaning, I think we had a totally different village, which was much more beautiful, very clean, very fresh. Wow. And all the plastics has disappeared. And while the students were reporting on this back to the community, how they were very moved by all these movements of the youth, etc. So the villagers said, yes, we did have some cleaning communities. Now we will revive them. Now we, and the chief of the village made a promise that he would, you know, really pay attention to this, that all the communities are at work and clean their neighborhoods, etc. So we left a cleaner village. And at the same time, you know, with also new ideas, new initiatives and in the village.
Yeah.
And this, I think this, these are some of the initiatives we can, we take, but I mean, also all sorts of other, you know, initiatives, like really it's about matching the students' interests, ideas, and also the local needs. Yeah, so the academic programs are essential to the emergence of eco-villages in the Sahel region.
Excellent.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of our podcast Audaciousness. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. A huge thanks to Dr. Ousmane Pam for sharing the information about his project. Such an interesting discussion and such a fascinating and audacious goal that he did. Thank you so much, Usman.
Yes, thank you from me as well. If you as a listener enjoyed this episode, please give it a like, tell people that you love and those that you don't love, tell them to listen to us because you can learn a lot from it. You can get inspired and you can just improve your life. If you know anyone that we should interview, then let us know because then we might just do that.
Indeed. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another audacious person and another audacious episode. See you then.
Bye.
Bye.